Good afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And you can find all sorts of good information about the program, contact information for us, too. If you have ideas for programs or you want to sound off about anything, it's wethepeopleradio.us. And when you go there, it's got our phone numbers and email addresses and everything. We like to hide right out in the open. You have archives dating back to 2010. Lots of good information there. We've done a bunch of shows about veterans. I need to create a new tab about Islam and refugees because we've done so many different shows with so many different guests and probably a tab on national security. But for the time being, you can fan through the archives and pick those out if those are topics that you like. And the sponsor for this hour,
Team Power, our local John Deere Kubota dealer. Contact them now for their service special.
Because the grass is growing right now.
The grass is growing. You know, it's only February, and we're supposed to be having, well, of course, we are having a little bit of cold weather, but the sun's out. We haven't had any rain for, gosh, a month or better. And that grass is growing like a foot a day.
Dog got a tick the other day.
Yeah, I know the ticks are out, too.
Dog never gets ticks in February.
Yeah, so call Team Power if you want some work done on your tractor or you want a great deal on a Kubota or John Deere tractor. They'll fix you up and give you some expertise on what's the best buy and what's the best tractor for your need. So give them a call, 226-9226. They're at 3119 Twinview Boulevard out there next to Phil's Propeller. Give them a call.
Right there off I-5.
Right.
Super
off.
Simple.
Very
Monday through
simple.
Friday,
Monday
8
through
to
Friday,
5.
8 to 5, yeah.
Any other good stuff we're forgetting? Parts? Service?
Parts, service. They
sales?
Do it, they do it all. Yeah.
It's incredible.
They're your one-stop shop right there.
If you go there and look around, you might see Bill.
Yeah, you might.
So you could just go up there to heckle him, actually.
Yeah, I'm
just
good
add that to the little commercial.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Yeah, we can.
There's a heckling opportunity.
Yeah, we can deal with hecklers. That's okay.
Yeah, if you have any complaints, just go up to Team Power and complain to Bill.
Yeah, there you are.
Our guest last hour was Peter Friedman, and he's sticking with us for the second hour because we're going to shift gears a tiny bit to refugee resettlement. He is an all-around smart guy on lots of different topics. I had to close my stupid computer. You have the 50-year award from the FAA for the Master Mechanic Award. Got that in 2016. Been a firearms instructor for over 50 years. Done more stuff than, I mean, you're like the Army. How did that commercial used to go? You know, you've done more stuff they've done more stuff by breakfast than we do all day.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
right.
Yeah, that's
be you. All you can be.
Yeah, there you go. So how about this? For our guests that haven't heard you before, what, I mean, obviously 50 years in the FAA, the flight industry and flying all sorts of different kinds of planes and did a little stint there with some dopes at the FBI trying to help them catch criminals, which was harder than it sounded to work with the FBI, not catch the criminals. You know, all these different things. So what led you into the study of Islam?
Well, many, many years ago, and we're going to go back to when I was 9, which would have been 1953, I guess, 54, somewhere in there.
Man, you're old.
what can I tell?
Said Bill.
My dad.
Said the old guy sitting next to me.
Yeah, there you go. Well, old age and treachery will always overcome youth and skill.
Exactly.
Absolutely. When you cross that threshold, you know it.
I'm counting on it.
Oh, I'm telling you. So, no, way back when, my father was one of the founders in 1938 of the Jewish temple in Beverly Hills called Temple Emmanuel. And he was the executive director there for 22 years. And every time I used to tell people that, you know, and they would say, oh, is he a rabbi? I would say, no, he's honest.
Nice.
Which we can talk about on another program. Anyway, so I grew up there, and I used to go on the weekends. You know, we had Saturday school, Sunday school, whatever. And my father would take me down there with him while he checked on everything. And I would sit in the library at the temple, and I would read. And discovered a number of things during that period of time. I love Napoleon, and we can do a whole program on that because I lecture on Napoleon all the time. And I discovered that there are two groups of people that I really was fearful of and didn't like. The first, of course, were Nazis, because we had a number of people who were members of the temple who had been in Auschwitz and other concentration camps. And the other ones I didn't like were the Muslims, because in reading the books that I read, I discovered that the Muslims, for some unknown reason, were always on the side of the Germans. And they were on the side of the Germans in 1870 in the Franco-Prussian War, World War I, World War II especially. And the uncle of Yasser Arafat, who was Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, met with Hitler in 1941. You can look at Google and you'll see the pictures of Hitler and Amin al-Husseini sitting together. He's got his white turban on. But al-Husseini donated several regiments of Bosnian Muslims to the SS, who were then used in Poland and Czechoslovakia to slaughter Jews. So, you know, I kind of had a bad taste at that point, and I decided I wanted to find out what actually made people, human beings who were theoretically educated. And at that time, the German society was one of the most educated in the history of the world. They produced guys like Einstein and others. And so I started researching. And once I put all this research together, I started to talk to people about this. And studying the Quran, studying the origin of the Quran, which is really interesting. We can do a show on that if you'd like. Because all of the crescent symbols and the sun symbols and everything else that you find on mosques, well, they go way back to Egypt. And they go back to the time of Ramses. So, you know, if you look at all of this stuff with a critical eye and get away from the ideology, you know, there's reality and then there's the faith part. And faith is what you can't empirically prove. You've just got to take it on faith. So when you start to dissect this and you find all of these other things that become involved in how they were usurped by the followers of Muhammad, all right, and I referred to that last week as the Mohammedans, who were the followers of Muhammad, you discover where all of this stuff in the Quran actually came from. Now, it's interesting, in Arabic, it's referred to as al-Quran, al meaning the, and Quran meaning telling, because it was not written down at that time, of the time of Muhammad. This was all a transmitted to everybody back and forth verbally. So al-Quran in Arabic means the telling. So now you take a look at some of this stuff and you start to read these 114 chapters, 6,247 verses, and you can't read it. You can't sit down and read it, because they are answers to questions for the most part in these chapters in the Quran, and you don't have the question. All you have is the answer. And it's like the old Johnny Carson show. If you remember Johnny Carson, when he pretended to be Karnak.
Karnak, yeah.
And he would hold the card up to his turban, and he would give you the answer. Okay? And he would say, the answer is 4. And then he would open up the envelope, and he would read the question. Well, the problem is that in the Quran, 90% or better of everything written in the Quran are answers to questions that were posed theoretically by Muhammad to the angel Gabriel in the cave over 23 years. And the revelations are the answers that came from Allah through Gabriel answering these questions. So when you read this, it's totally disjointed. It's not in chronological order. The shortest chapter is the very first one, which contains what's called the Shahada. And it's only a few sentences long. That's chapter one. That's the pillar of faith of Islam. The second chapter, chapter two, is the longest chapter in the entire book. and they gradually get shorter and shorter and shorter until you get to the 114th chapter, which once again is very short.
All right. Hold that thought, Peter. We'll come right back. We're actually taking our breaks on time today. It's a whole new idea. If it feels funny, that's because it's just a new idea. We'll be right back with our guest, Peter Friedman. You can find us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
We got too many gangsters doing dirty deeds. Too much corruption and crime in the streets. It's time the long arm of the law put a few more in the ground. Send them all to their maker and he'll settle them down. You can bet he'll settle them down. Justice is the one thing you should always find. You gotta saddle up your boys, you gotta draw a hard line. When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune, and we'll all meet back at the local saloon. And we'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, saying, whiskey for my men, beer for my horses. Whiskey for my
All right, Peter, where do you want to go? The last thing you said was the final chapter was super short. Why did that happen anyway? They just lose enthusiasm?
No, it's just the first 93 chapters were written in Mecca. And what happened was Muhammad initially, and this is all in Frank Burley's book, by the way. It's all about Muhammad. So you
highly recommend that.
Best book ever.
Yeah, you'd have to read the actual documented life story of Muhammad. And, you know, he grew up with the Jewish tribe, the Quraysh, that was living in Mecca at the time. There was a Christian group that was there. And then you had the pagan Arabs. And he grew up, you know, in the midst of all of these people. He pretty much grew up all by himself. You know, his mother was gone, his father was gone. And he was influenced by these various groups, and he was somewhat drawn to the Jewish tribe in the Old Testament, and decided that, you know, he, and this is only my opinion, of course, based on my research, that he could probably convince the Jews that he was the third and last prophet after Moses and Jesus, and started to come up with these revelations, and again, you'd have to read Frank's book, because he just has done a magnificent job, and he wrote these 93 revelations that he supposedly had received out sitting in the cave, you know, from the angel Gabriel sent to him by Allah. And he went to the Jews, and he was constantly hammering them, saying, look, you know, this is what God is telling me, and you have to believe me and accept me and everything. And finally, they decided, you know, in their best Monty Python way, got a very nice one, and we don't need you. You know, if you remember Monty Python
yes.
and the Holy Grail.
You know, we need to play more of that.
He really irritated them to the point where they chased him out of town, and he and his 12 followers decided to go about 200 miles north to Medina, and that's where the balance of the chapters were written, which are all of the war and violent chapters.
But weren't the original writings that he came up with kind of centered around Judaism?
That's correct. And if you read the Quran, he talks a lot about Moses and Abraham trying to weave this story together to lead to the conclusion that the Jewish tribe in Mecca should accept him
right.
as the prophet. And then they chase him out of town, and obviously sour grapes set in there, and I'm going to show them. And so he goes to Medina, and if you go to Book 2, verse 106, that's called the abrogation verse, because all of the original Meccan verses were passive. They defined the faith. And then when he went to Medina, he had to find a way to abrogate the passive verses that he had already come up with and replace them with the other ones. So when you go to Book 2, verse 106, it says that, you know, Allah will abrogate certain verses and give you better ones. And so that's what happened up in Medina. So now he gets a bunch of these people together in Medina. And what happened was he appealed to the pagan Arabs. And if you see on your website, you put up the IQ thing,
yep.
the research
right.
on the Middle East IQ. Well, so he gets hold of the pagan Arabs and he has them look at the spice and silk caravans that are proceeding unprotected across the northern peninsula of Saudi of Arabia at the time. And he basically goes to them and says, hey, look, you know, if you'll believe in my God, you can steal and rape and kill and do whatever you want to with these caravans, and you can keep 80%, but 20% is reserved for Allah, and since I'm his messenger, you just give me the 20%. And from a historical perspective, if you go back that far, that's what occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And so gradually they started to accumulate wealth by attacking these caravans. And as they accumulated wealth, they bought horses, they bought armaments, and created an army, and the rest is history until they were stopped. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, where all of this stuff came from. Now, where did the Quran come from? The actual written Quran was not put together and collated until the third successor to Muhammad, because it went through Ali. Ali was married to Fatima, who was Muhammad's daughter. And Ali, of course, was assassinated. This is where the Shiites separate from the Sunnis, because the Shiites believe that the descendants of Ali should be the rightful successor in Islam. And from Ali, it went to Uthman, and then Uthman didn't fare very well either for several years. And then after he was gone, you come to Umar, and Umar is the guy who got all of the followers of Muhammad together at that point, because they were now old. They had been involved in all of these battles. They were getting killed off, and Umar convened a conference, if you will, in modern terms. And he said, okay, he says, any of you guys, he says, you know, who were with Muhammad when questions were asked and the answers were given, you need to write those down. So that they got something like 60,000 index cards turned into headquarters. And Umar had to put a group together to go through all of these things. And this is where the hadith comes from of Bukhari. You know, what is truth and what is made up for, you know, somebody's ego and stuff like that. Well, they threw out a whole bunch of this stuff from various people who had, you know, sent their index cards in. And they then took all this information, they wrote it down, and that is where the Quran came from.
Which is why it doesn't read like a story.
Exactly.
Frank's book is great, and so for people who might be driving or not have a pen in their hand, we have linked that on our site underneath the title "We Recommend." It's in the sidebar of all of our stuff. We did a couple shows with Frank about that
yeah.
book. Really a good read, and you know you would think it would be kind of boring because it's a biography, but it isn't. It's
very compelling.
Much like a
spy thriller. You won't put it down because it does read like a story, and it moves pretty quickly,
and it makes sense of a lot of stuff. All
yeah,
of a sudden,
really
you see these things come into focus.
It all together. Uh-huh.
So shift that to
let's talk about refugees.
To the refugee thing, yeah, because I'm looking at some of these reports that you have sent us that I've linked on the page.
Let's walk through it and start at the beginning.
So all right.
If you pull up the 2017 proposed refugee admissions, fiscal year 2017. Now, the government's fiscal year starts October 1st and ends the following year on September 30th. So this is basically the fiscal year 2016-2017. So if you look at the title page, by the 1965 Immigration and Naturalization Act, or Nationality Act, that was rammed through Congress by LBJ, Joe Biden, and I wish somebody would bring this up to old Joe, and Ted Kennedy. And I think I told you last week that they pushed this thing through for the simple reason that they wanted to have a way of bringing Vietnamese refugees back here and creating them as Democrats, ultimately. And now, you know, we're doing the same thing with the Syrian refugees and everything else. So this just keeps repeating itself. So you're looking at this report to the Congress, and this report has to be given to the Senate and House Judiciary Committees every year. And it says submitted on behalf of the President of the United States, and that would have been Barack at that time, in fulfillment of the requirements of the Immigration and Nationality Act. Now, who contributes to this document? Department of State, and this is one of the reasons why Nunes is now going after the State Department, and hopefully Rex Tillerson's doing a good job there cleaning that swamp out, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and then the worst offender here is the Department of Health and Human Services. And hopefully our new director of that is trying to clean that out. So if you jump from that to page 5, there is a table on page 5, and it's stated, refugee admissions program for fiscal 2017, proposed ceilings, table number 1. And it talks about refugee admissions in fiscal year 2015 and 2016, and the proposed refugee admissions by region for fiscal 2017. So the proposed 27, let's go down to 16 or 15 first. At the bottom of the page, you have roughly 70,000. The majority of which were coming from Africa and from the Near East and South Asia, and that kind of includes Burma, which is what, Myanmar now, I guess it is, and some of the Middle East countries, Afghanistan, Iraq, so that from that region, you wind up with close to 70,000 that they told the judiciary committees that the president was going to bring in fiscal 2015.
Now, that was predominantly Muslim, correct?
That's correct. Well, there's a lot of other tables in there that will tell you precisely how many came in from which specific countries. It will tell you the ages, both male and female, the average nominal ages, and then when you get down to the end of the document, it talks about the 9 charities that are exclusive to the State Department for refugee resettlement. Nobody else can play the game.
Only
and the
those.
$1 billion a year that they get to resettle these refugees, and the states and cities that are the preferred resettlement states and cities. California and Texas, of course, are number one.
Yeah, in your town. We've got to take a really quick break, and then we'll be right back. But I would encourage people who have the ability to go online while we're talking to you or while you're listening, wethepeopleradio.us, and click on the page for today, February 25th, and check out some of the PDF files that he has there. It's a lot of really good information. We'll be right back with our guest, Peter Friedman.
The immigration scene, shining and feeling clean, could it be a sin? I got stopped by the immigration man. He said he doesn't know if he can. Let me in, let me in.
another day let me in. Immigration man, I won't toe your line today. I can't see it anyway.
There you go, Peter. That's the setup for what they're doing at the immigration office.
There you go.
Anyway, if you take a look at that page 5 on there for 2017, it also states that the president may specify circumstances under which individuals who are within their countries of nationality or last habitual residence may be considered a refugee for purposes of admission to the United States. So when Obama was in office, you can see how every year this kept escalating.
Oh, big time.
And then it says fiscal 2017 refugee admissions proposal recommends continuing such in-country processing for specified persons in Iraq, Cuba, Eurasia, the Baltics, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. Can you say MS-13?
Right. Also, when you look at the numbers, when they give you the breakdown of the numbers on that chart, and that's pretty interesting, too.
Oh, yeah. But now cross over and go to 2018, and you will see what Trump has done. In 2018, Trump has taken this from 110,000 in the ceiling for 2017, and he has dropped that now down to 45,000. But in there, you still have 19,000 coming from mainly Muslim-controlled African countries. Cut that number almost in half from the last 7-8 years. And then you have 17,000 down from 35,000 from the mainly Middle East and Asian Muslim countries. So Trump has definitely cut that, you know, way down.
Yeah, he didn't exactly, you know, he didn't cut it off, and I think that's what the mainstream media would love to have you believe, is that he's just closed the door. There's still a fair amount coming in.
What does this look like historically, since you've looked at this a lot more than we have? Has it always been like this, or is this were these new, did this change?
Now, if you do the research, you'll discover that this has been pretty much promulgated by the Democrat Party. It went way up in 65. Like I said, there was very little immigration, if any, between 1924 and 1964. And then Joe Biden and Ted Kennedy got together and came up with this novel idea of bringing all of these third world people in here, putting them on welfare, making them Democrats, and then ultimately nationalizing.
And they said that out loud. I mean, you're not just guessing that and putting it out there.
No, you have my PowerPoint presentation that you put up.
Right, it's well documented. I mean, just for people that are listening that aren't looking at the backup information you sent. I mean, that isn't stuff anybody's got to make up. They actually said that was the plan.
Well, Al Gore and Bill Clinton in 1996, for his reelection, they went out and they nationalized 330,000 people that came out of Somalia and other third world countries, and they nationalized them in order to have them vote in his reelection in 96. I mean, if you want to take the time to go through stuff, you will find all of this. But most people, you know, bitch and moan about it, but they're lazy. They're lazy. They don't do the legwork, you know, to find all of this stuff, and it's all there, and Congress knows about it, you know. The other thing that really scares me at this point is that the UN High Commissioner for Refugees up until about 3 or 4 months ago, was a guy named Luis Gutierrez. Well, Gutierrez, if that name is familiar to you, used to be the communist president of Portugal, who was involved with the International Communist Party, and now he happens to be the Secretary General of the UN.
Terrific.
And this is the guy who had to approve all of the refugees coming to the United States. And we set up these refugee camps over there in Syria, for example, in Jordan, and they were funded by the UN, and they're full of Muslims. People want to know, how come we're not bringing any Christians in, Christian refugees? Well, the problem is, the way the game got played, Guterres said that, okay, if you're going to get the UN recommendation to come to America, you have got to register in one of our UN-maintained refugee camps. Well, and now imagine a Christian family attempting to go into a Muslim refugee camp in order to, you know, come in.
Yeah.
And the Muslims threw them out. They wouldn't let them come in. That's why there's no Christian refugees coming in. So there are local Christian groups who are resettling, you know, persecuted Christians from the Middle East. But the whole UN thing, it's all driven by the OIC, or the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. And they're totally in cahoots with them. So when you go further down towards the end, all of your tables, and I'm on, for example, I'm on page 56 of the 2018 report. And when you take a look at that, here's refugee arrivals by country of origin. And this is back now from fiscal year 2016, 2017. That was Obama. So you've got 2,700 from Afghanistan. You've got 5,800, and these are all Muslims, 5,800 from Bhutan. You have 12,000 from Burma. You've got 16,000 from the Republic of the Congo, Eritrea, Ethiopia. You have some from the former Soviet Union that are like the Chechens.
Iran and Iraq, big numbers.
Yeah, Iran and Iraq, 3,750 from Iran, almost 10,000 coming out of Iraq. Let's see, where's some more?
Oh, and then zoom down to the fun number, 9,000 out of Somalia.
There you go, 9,020 just out of Somalia. Thank you, Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, some of this stuff, you just, here's Syria, 12,000 on page 58.
Yeah.
Yep.
Here's 1,458 from Sudan. Here's 12,587 from Syria. You know, and it keeps on going. And you look at these tables, look at the next table. On page 59, the median age and gender of the refugee arrivals. Look at the percentage of males, and look at the median age.
Yep, they're all fighting
okay.
age.
These are all refugees of military age. Syria, the median age is 20.
Yeah, 47% female, 52% male.
Exactly. Look at Burma, same thing. 52% are males, average age 22.
But they always talk about how it's women and children.
It's bull.
But that's just a lie.
Nonsense, and here is the documented proof.
Yep.
Here is the absolute documented proof. Here's select age categories, for example, page 60. And this is all public record. It's now on your website. Anybody can go and access it and just read this stuff. And then you go down further. Here, page 61, refugee arrivals by state. Okay, where are all of these going? 7,900 of them. California.
California.
I mean, just, hello?
Yeah,
Michigan.
That's the largest percentage in the entire country.
And then you go down to Texas. 7,800 went to Texas.
Hmm. You know, all 5,000 went into New York. I mean, there'll be some alarm bells there.
Well, you start looking at California's you know, at the weight on the system, on the school system, on the welfare rolls, on all those things. And people, of course, say, well, they can't get welfare, but these people come here, can't speak the language.
Well, Starbucks hired 10,000 of them. And Howard Schultz, he wants 10,000 more.
Wow.
I'm not surprised. Look at Kentucky. 2,400 from Kentucky, where they just built the huge mega mosque in Murfreesboro.
Oh.
So if you go back to 2001, for example, there were 900 mosques that were in the United States. Today, there's over 3,500. Wow. You build them, they will come.
Exactly. In that order.
Well, those are mostly all moderate Muslims.
Yeah, that's right. They're just religion fees.
That's why they're here.
All righty, really quick break, and we'll be back with our guest, Peter Friedman, here listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I don't think that's what they were saying about. I don't know.
Use the music for our own purposes. So, Peter,
all right, when you
scroll down on this thing, because during the commercial we're scrolling down,
United, go to page 64.
Yeah, that's the one. Percentage of total resettled, United States 62%
of all the countries,
as opposed to Hungary, who took four people.
And we were catching all kinds of flack for not letting enough in. Remember that?
Yeah, we had 78,000 people as opposed to Hungary's four. But while we're talking about this, though, isn't the whole refugee idea they come here until their country stops doing whatever it is that's doing, which is probably killing them or other people or each other, and then they're supposed to go back, right? Isn't this a temporary deal?
It's supposed to be. However, let me tell you what the scam is.
Yeah. That's
we're going back to making new Democrats. If you come in here as a legal refugee, just the way I have documented on the PowerPoint that you put up on your website, you come in here, you get a green card as a refugee, you get federal aid, all right? That goes on for about 6 months. They turn you over to the local counties now. And the feds go out and they find a bunch more to bring in here. They work through these nine charities who go through $1 billion with these charities. You would not believe how much money the people who run these charities make, $400,000 or $500,000 a year. And most of them are Catholic charities, which just blows my mind when you take a look at who the nine charities are. They designate specific states and cities where they're going to resettle these people, you know, and as soon as you have the green card as a legal refugee, that is your automatic pathway to citizenship. If you come here illegally, and this is part of the DACA thing and all the parents that brought them here, there is no path legally to citizenship. You have to create that path. But if you come here as under asylum, or you come here as a legal refugee under that Nationality Act, you are entitled to apply for citizenship. So now you take a look at the countries where these people are coming from. You look at the age of these people. You take a look at, the IQ report. And obviously, they're going to be Democrats.
Ouch.
No argument here.
You know, I mean, it's the old adage, when you rob Peter to pay Paul, you always get Paul's vote. and then you wind up with a sore Peter in the process.
Huh. I hadn't thought of it that way, but now, of course, we are tainted for life.
It's all here. It's all there, and all anybody has to do is just take a look at it. You know,
yeah,
the
PowerPoint has great information. That's well worth the time.
And you took Guterres, you know, and you put him as the fox in charge of the hen house. You know, now he's the Secretary General of the UN. So, you know, at some point, I mean, just thank God we elected Donald Trump. Can you imagine if we had elected Hillary Clinton?
No, it would have been like pouring gas on a fire.
Honest to God, all of this stuff coming out now would all have been swept under the carpet. They would have gotten away with it. The Bureau and DOJ would have continued doing what they were doing. And somehow I get up every morning and I thank the good Lord. I'll tell you, he was watching out this time.
Well,
enough is enough.
With all of this this refugee thing, talk about the charities that are involved, and why are there only a handful? What did you say, nine of them?
Nine charities. Yeah, those are nine exclusive charities that are contracted with by the Department of State. Nobody else can get in there. It's been that way for years, and they are in charge of doing, you know, what you have to characterize as this charitable work in bringing these people in here. Our tax money goes to these people until, and this is the bad part, until about 6 months are up, and then these people are resettled, and we have people resettled here in Contra Costa County, for example. 2 years ago, I was on the civil grand jury, and we looked into this, of course, and the county of Contra Costa has 1,200,000 residents in the entire county. I think we're the ninth largest county in the state.
Explain to your traffic.
We have a general welfare budget of almost $540 million. Now, when I go down to the regional medical center down in Martinez, and we went in there and took a whole tour by the grand jury, you would not believe how many robes and hijabs were in there getting free health care because Walnut Creek is one of the identified cities for resettlement, as is San Diego, Modesto, and Sacramento. And they're in there and they're grabbing resources. If you go to, for example, they have a refugee card that's given to them by the Department of State and Homeland Security, and I've got that on the PowerPoint.
I'm looking at it.
There's a sample of it, and if they walk into a pharmacy with a prescription, any pharmacy with a prescription, they get that medicine for free by just showing the refugee card.
Hmm.
Wow.
What I noticed on the PowerPoint here, you have refugee furniture. What's the story there?
Okay, you know all these people trying to get from Tunisia across the Mediterranean to Greece and Italy,
in the boats,
and then get intercepted. Well, the Greek Navy intercepted a cargo ship. Theoretically, on the manifest, it said it was furniture for the refugee camp in Cyprus. And when the Greek Navy boarded the boat and they opened up the containers, that's what they found. Now, do you remember the movie Patton?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, you remember the famous scene in there with Field Marshal Montgomery and Ike's number two guy, General Beetle Smith, are in the bathroom. And Montgomery blows, you know, on the mirror and steams up the mirror, and he draws a picture of the island of Sicily. And he says the key to the invasion of Southern Europe and Italy is going to be through Sicily. And then they make the funny comment, isn't it amazing that, you know, the final invasion of Italy is taking place here in a latrine. And if you go back and you watch the movie again, where Patton, George Patton, makes the comment that from the Mediterranean and from northern Africa, the Carthaginians, everybody came across from Libya and Tunisia and landed in Sicily and then went to Syracuse, and from there they went into Italy. Well, it's only 400 miles from the boot of Italy to the Vatican. And if you recall, the head al-Baghdadi of ISIS made the comment that you at some point will see the black flag of ISIS fly over the Vatican.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And where are all these refugees coming from? They're all coming through Libya. Thank you, Hillary Clinton and Sid Blumenthal, for destroying, you know, Gaddafi. And so all of these refugees and the rubber boats and everything, you don't see a whole lot of women in those boats.
No. No, they're all young men.
And they're all guys of military age.
Right.
And they get rescued by the Italian Navy and the Greek Navy. And I'm telling you, they're committing suicide by bringing these people into Sicily, into Cyprus, because they are going to begin to migrate, as right, I have right there in the PowerPoint, showing how they are migrating right up there across the Mediterranean. It's only 150 miles, you know, from Libya to Sicily.
Well, if the furniture seizures were actually arms, is that correct?
Oh, yeah, they were arms. They were arms that were headed for the refugee camp.
Right, right. Yeah, so that that should tell you everything you need to know about what their intentions are.
Well, it's been their intentions for 1,400 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know why we were attacked on 9/11?
Tell me.
Because the last major defeat of the Muslim army was at the gates of Vienna on September 11, 1683. They hold a grudge. That was the last major defeat of the Muslim army.
A long grudge.
Yeah.
Hey, well, tell us really quickly, we've got like a minute left. In your PowerPoint, you have a thing here, they get privacy rights with this refugee card. What exactly?
Oh, yeah.
What does that entail before we let you go here?
Well, if you were to go to Department of State or Homeland Security and you ask them to please identify how many refugees, for example, that were relocated in Walnut Creek, California, they won't tell you. And they said, because of this act, we are not going to tell you where we have put these people.
Lovely.
So you go to Idaho, for example, and you go to Twin Falls, they have a lot of problems now because they are relocating a lot of the Syrian refugees in Twin Falls and Idaho. They're having a lot of problems, a lot of crime. I mean, you can look this up. Go to Google.
Big surprise.
Well, we're out of time.
Peter Friedman, as always, informative and ready to spring load for a bunch of other programs. So we will get hold of you to do that. Have an awesome weekend.
We've been traveling far.